What's up, everyone? Welcome back to another episode of Stats for Lefties. In today's episode, we answer the question of how in the world did the Green Party win control of Mid-Suffolk Council? And I'm going to talk to Alex Catt, a Green Party councillor in Norwich in the east of England, who was involved in the campaign, closely involved in the campaign, to take Mid-Suffolk Council from the Conservatives for the Green Party. We talked about house building, local plans, what it's like to be a councillor, the extraordinary results for the Green Party. It was a really interesting and educational discussion, and let's get right into it. The first question I was hoping to ask you was, so I think it was two weeks ago now, the local elections? Green Party had their best results ever, by far, in terms of number of councils, first one, number of councillors, gains, everything across the board was the best. Why do you think that was? Why do you think it happened this year specifically? Because there have been other local elections. 2019 was pretty good, was very good. Others were pretty good, but this was off the scale. What do you think distinguished this year from all the others?
I think there's a few things. I think it does show that we have really good ground campaigns, and that we have really stepped up our game in terms of organising, with really good strategy across the country, as well as locally and regionally as well. We have candidates that work hard and that are actually rooted in their communities, and you can undersell that. But I think it's a massive reason why people vote Green. I mean, just locally, and every time I'm door knocking, that is usually one of the biggest reasons people say that they're voting Green. And unless you have that, we're not going to get the massive gains that we want to see. But the organizing aspect is probably the biggest part of it. I mean, people know how to run election campaigns now that really promote the fact that they do work hard and that they are the ones actually doing things in their communities. And that's been the difference, really. I mean, you look at 2019 compared to 2023. 2019 was the biggest set of local election results that we had at the time. It was huge. I remember it coming in. And so this was always going to be a massive challenge to the Green Party in 2023, defending our biggest number of seats ever, on top of also obviously wanting to make gains in all of these other places.
It's like 55% of all Green councillors were up for election this year. Like all Green councillors. And with Labour, it was like 40%. So that was like the level of like how front-loaded it was. And that's why I remember going on Bright Green and hearing Chris Jarvis told me that the target the Greens had set was 100. And I was like, yeah, that seems about right. Probably wouldn't get any more than that, given the background. And then they just blew past it.
Such a big challenge. I mean, you've got the defending their biggest number of seats, wanting to, to make strategic gains in all these other places, and also it being right before a general election. That obviously feeds into that strategy as well. And then you've got, a Labour Party that are really strong in the polls. And traditionally, that was the party that we would get votes off of. So that was also another contributing factor to why, it looked like this was such a big challenge. But again, it's the fact that we have candidates that work hard. And in those places where we elected Greens in 2019, we've seen those people re-elected. Obviously there are pockets where that's not happened, and that's going to happen for every single party. But overwhelmingly, people have been re-elected and we've made huge gains. I mean, we've seen this in local elections since 2019, in 2021, 2022, where there were smaller election cycles that actually, where Greens are elected, one, people like it and we see those people re-elected with bigger majorities or taking all of the seats in, say a three-seat ward. But also in places where we've made breakthroughs, people actually see that local action and then want that in other areas. You look at places like East Hearts, where we went from, 2 to 19. I may be slightly wrong on the numbers there.
No, that's right. I think it was one.
One to 19. And there's, phenomenal. There's other places like that as well. I mean, East Suffolk as well. I mean, we'll get onto Mid Suffolk later, but East Suffolk went from 5 to 16 as well to become the largest party. They're now going to be running the council in a minority administration. And the same thing happens in Baber, which is essentially South Suffolk, because no one seems to know where Baber is or how to say it.
I thought it was Baburg.
A lot of people did. Went from 4 to 10. Even places like Norwich, which elects in thirds, so the gains are never going to be as spectacular as that, going from 11 to 13. And there's lots of other places around the country. I could go on and on and on. But it comes down to people seeing that local action, having candidates that actually do things, and really organising well and learning lessons election after election after election about how to do that. I mean, nationally, to be honest, people are very upset with the Conservative government, and that played a part in it, especially in those rural areas, because essentially we were the only credible force that was not Conservative in a lot of these rural areas. The Labour Party, not present at all. If they are, they're not speaking to people in the way that people want to. They're not giving them much of an alternative. And in urban areas, you know, they're disappointing a lot of people as well, and they're turning people off. And the Lib Dems as well, I mean, they have their pockets of support as well, but aren't, I don't think they quite get it as much in terms of that local action. So there's lots of different factors there. They've combined to such an impressive result. I think internally, we've known that this was going to happen because we've been there, watching these campaigns and watching them develop over years. And so I know it always takes the media by surprise, but it's because people work hard and we've had a strategy to actually organise to get these people elected.
I did have the thought today that the Green Party has managed to achieve more electoral success in first past the post elections even than UKIP did at its peak with tenth of the media coverage. Which, to my mind, I think speaks to the fact that the Green vote is more, durable.
Yeah.
It took a little longer to build up, it's built very quickly in a short amount of time in the past 2 years, but before that it was slowly building. Mm-hmm. And then it reached a critical mass, and then...
We've gained in a sustainable way. A sustainable way that has also been incredibly impressive and incredibly dramatic as well. I mean, I think UKIP's problem was, you know, they had some nice ways of communicating nationally that people found popular at a time when they were looking for a protest vote against, you know, Labour and the Tories. But that never, ever transitioned into actual organising for elections on a local level, ever. You know, it was never people working hard in their communities and standing to become councillors because they want to make a difference, and having any sort of electoral strategy behind that. It was all based on, you know, having this big figurehead that would, you know, get votes in a national election. And you see this exact same thing with Reform now. You know, they poll, they for some reason they're prompted in every general election poll and get a sizable vote share from that. But in the local elections, barely had any candidates, and those that they did didn't win because there was no organising behind it. There's no actual work. These people aren't invested in their communities. And it's the same reason other parties fail and make losses to us is because they're just not doing the work, and then even if they organize, they can't counter that, really. So it's like a combination of factors that has come to mean that we have this really sustainable growth, and I think 2023 was the big test for us, and we've passed that
flying colors. Yes, I do remember thinking it was like it 2023, I think, as you say, was a big test of was the 2019 result a sort of flash in the pan, like prompted by, you know, both major party leaders had huge unpopularity, Brexit chaos, European elections coming up, and then one could have easily made a case, though I don't think it would have been right to say that that was a one-off that would go back down. And had it been, 2023 would not have been what it was, but it didn't happen. So I think I'd definitely add some weight to the idea that the 2019 gains were very real and lasting as well. Speaking of gains, the next question I was hoping to ask you, and you seem particularly well qualified to talk about this because you were involved in it, was the Green Party's majority victory in Mid-Suffolk. And as I'm sure many people have said to you, if people were to list the council that people
think the Greens would win a majority on. The number one would be Brighton, and then probably followed by maybe Lancaster, Bristol, Mid-Suffolk. What happened there? Like, how did a avowedly left-wing party that has a broad church, but it is avowedly left-leaning, how did it win in, like, true blue, solid Tory area?
I think the first thing to preface this is that, you know, Greens have had councillors in Mid-Suffolk for about 20 years. You know, again, it's this idea of sustainable growth. You know, this hasn't come out of nowhere. I mean, it was a huge increase, you know, going from 12 to 24 and taking majority control of the council with like a super majority. But, you know, we
won
did
a majority
have,
of the popular vote as well.
Yeah. And we did have, but we did have 12 councillors before this election. And the reason why this has happened is because, and from working with them, they have candidates that are so rooted in their communities. People know who they are. They work hard and they get things done. And I know that's the same answer I had for the first question, but it's true for Mid-Suffolk as well, and especially true in those rural areas. That is so, so, so important. But also, you know, our policies, our left-wing policies work in rural areas. They just do. And I think that's the thing that people forget. People think, oh, you know, they're Tories, so they're not going to, you know, want the same things as the Green Party. But actually, the reason why they don't vote Labour is because the Labour Party has no organisation in these rural areas. They are nowhere to be seen. You know, they have zero councillors on Mid-Suffolk. They aren't able to talk to people in a way that, you know, is convincing at all. Whereas our policies, you know, investment in public transport, investment in rural infrastructure and services, and actually opposing austerity, does work there, because these are places that have been at the brunt of really lazy Tory councils that do not want to invest at all, and that has really hit hard for a lot of people. Protecting local environment and green spaces is also a big issue there, and also housing is a big issue as well. You know, we had this kind of slogan for our housing policies in this election called Right Homes, Right Place. You know, and I think that is, a lot of people say that the Greens are NIMBY, and that is not how we won this election. It's an acknowledgement that we need homes in these areas, but they need to be affordable. They need to be sustainable. You know, they need to have the right levels of insulation, and they need to be accessible for local people. And so that policy worked for people. And also on a very local level, Mid-Suffolk Council, you know, they don't even have a local plan. So development can just... is kind of a little bit out of control, and so there's
every council had to have a local plan. They not?
Well, this is the thing. This is why it's such a big surprise. Most local councils do have a local plan that will, you know, inform development and allow them to have some sort of control over the development that they see across their district. Mid-Suffolk has never had that. And that's why they've seen this huge increase in developments of places which are unaffordable, you know, with the not providing the correct level of infrastructure to support these developments. You know, in some places, a lot of people have felt like all of the green spaces in their villages or whatever have been, you know, vanished. And it's a very real reality that housing crisis is huge in urban areas, but it is also huge in rural areas. There's lots of people that live in villages that simply cannot afford to live there. Their families can't afford to live there. They don't have the services to support them. There's no infrastructure there because of, one, the Conservative government, but also because of very lazy Tory councils that refuse to invest. And so all of these local issues have combined, and the Green Party has been the only one that has really had a platform that people can believe in that will deal with those issues. I mean, you also have the Labour Party. I mean, people are very tribal, Tories and Labour. You know, they're very hostile to each other. But that doesn't necessarily extend to the Green Party, even though the Green Party is a more left-wing party than Labour Party and always has been. There isn't that same level of hostility towards the Green Party. And to be honest, the Labour Party have never even really bothered to work in these areas. So the Green Party has been the only one actually standing up to the Tories in these areas for decades, in places like Mid-Suffolk. And it's true in other places in Suffolk as well. And so that's part of it.
That was a very interesting point about the housing, because as you say, a lot of people will go after the Greens and accuse them of being, as you say, NIMBYs, which I imagine people know it. It stands for not in my backyard, which is, it's just, the implication is that they don't, they want like good things, but not in my backyard, like wind farms, but not in my backyard. But there is, I think, a perception of like, oh, well, there can't be any housing shortages in the countryside because, you know, there's land everywhere. But of course, much of that land is owned by farmers and landlords, isn't it? It's not available to be built on. And so they'll, developers, particularly, I suppose, in places like Mid-Suffolk, presumably they're building on green spaces that the village would use because they can't just build on, like, the property owned by
the one park that the village has, you know?
Yeah. So yeah, it's like people, I think they think of a rural area and they think, oh, there's all that land. How can people be complaining about building houses? And it's like, well, a lot of that land, and some of that in Norfolk and Suffolk, a lot of that land is owned by the monarchy. So it can't be built on. Mm. Anyway, that was a deviation from the point there for me.
But it is an interesting point that people forget about rural areas, that the housing crisis is there. You know, there is development that's happening, but it is wildly unaffordable for the people that do live there. You have this huge pressure of people wanting to move into these places. And those people can afford to move into those places. But what you don't see is the level of infrastructure and investment in local services and things like public transport that allow that to be anywhere near sustainable for those areas.
I was going to say, you were saying about the infrastructure for like rural developments. So there's like, they'll build a bunch of houses, but not really have the buses to get to and from there, or the shops around there, or the access to work. And that really does, that really is an issue that I think people don't talk about. Because of course, a lot of people will talk about housing development in a city. When you build in a city, like I remember there being this discussion when I lived in the Golden Triangle in Norwich, where over the whether or not a local car park should be turned into like a housing development. And there were some people complained about it, but it was nowhere near the issues that you'd have in a village, right? Because, you know, if they built the houses, the bus would be right there. You could walk into the city centre from there. It's a very different set of concerns.
Yeah, I mean, you have this. There's an example of a development that happened in Mid-Suffolk where the council managed to get an agreement that the developer had said, oh, we'll provide a bus stop, but there was no buses to actually stop at the bus stop. This is true in so many places in Suffolk. I mean, from having to work there, it is so difficult to get around if you don't drive. So difficult. Buses just are not present. I mean, a lot of people talk about affordable public transport, but in Suffolk, the conversation, and this, you know, extends to other rural areas, places in Norfolk as well, it is literally just about getting public transport, about getting a bus. Even just having one bus route in a lot of places would be a huge improvement, because that just doesn't exist. And that is the level of the infrastructure in these places. You know, a lot of these places then don't also have good access to other public services like dentists, you know, GP surgeries. And again, the transport to and from those places is incredibly difficult. So again, it's all, you know, car dependent. And the cost of living crisis is very real in these places as well. So you have all of these combined.
Of course, use a lot more petrol and stuff. Yeah.
So I think that is kind of a forgotten thing about rural areas.
When I went back to London, because I was born in London, I lived there for 18 years, and I've lived in Norwich for the past 11 years now. So eventually I will have lived in Norwich longer than I lived in London, and then I will have to stop calling myself a Londoner. Or rather, I will be free from the label of Londoner. But I remember going back, and I can mock the people there because I am from London. But I was talking to people who were complaining about like the bus. It's like, oh God, the train, like it was 6 minutes late. And it's like, oh God, yeah, the bus is like, it said it would be here in 5 minutes. It was here in seven. I'm like, you
come to Norfolk.
Come to
Suffolk.
Norwich.
Come
that was
to Norwich,
thing.
Ethan.
I can
honestly
complain in Norwich about Norwich, like things coming once every half an hour. But yeah, like there's just such a disconnect of understanding between people who commentate on public transport, like journalists, media commentators, politicians who live in London, or work in London most of the time, and the actual needs of rural and even small urban areas, because I mean Norwich is an urban area, but it's a small urban area. The borough I come from in London, Barnet, is three times the population of Norwich, so it's not a very big city. I love it, but it's not very big. I did have one more question about Mid Suffolk. I remember seeing some people say that the environmental issues may have played a role as well in the election. Obviously, there's been lots of issues around sewage, water pollution. But in general sense, were there like major environmental issues that also prompted people to flip from Tory to Green?
Yeah, definitely. That was another issue. I mean, we did talk on a hyper-local level about green spaces and local environment. And the lack of a local plan also affects that, in that a lot of places that traditionally would be protected in other rural areas or in some urban areas simply had no protection because of the lack of any local plan. So there's no really sustainable development that's happening in this place, because developers can take the council to court if it gets rejected at a planning committee very easily. But yeah, you do have...
Oh, because there's no plan?
Yeah, yeah. It's a lot harder for, like, the councillors on those committees just do not have those rules in place to say, this is why we're rejecting a planning application. And so if they do it, they can be taken... The council can be taken to court. And so that is why a lot of these, like, green spaces and environmental areas that would be protected in other places just aren't. And so it's kind of a free-for-all for developers. So there's that. But then you do have the sewage issue, which has been a big thing that's hit a lot of people in Suffolk. Because people do care about their local environment. You know, they really do. And I think people, again, they make an assumption that because people are conservative, that they don't care about the environment, they don't care about climate change. But that isn't actually true. Also, as well, I mean, in these places, the Labour Party has never been a credible force. And so the way that people vote is different because there's just a lack of choice there. And the Green Party has been the only voice opposing the Tories for a long time in a lot of areas. But sewage has been a big thing. And obviously, Therese Coffey is the MP for Suffolk Coastal. And so that has been, it's been a big issue because she has been in the cabinet and all of her failures have been very highly publicised as well. And so... It's just another issue that adds on to all of these other issues that people have been voting Green for. I mean, there's also Sizewell C is planned for kind of Suffolk Coastal as well. So I wouldn't say it's been a huge issue across Suffolk, but in the places directly around, that has been as well for people that are concerned about that.
So you yourself are a local councillor here in Norwich. What does being a councillor, I asked this, I think, of Chris as well, but it's different cities, different authorities. What does being a councillor involve? And how have you found the experience? I'm not sure how long you've been a councillor for, at least a few years, I think.
I have been a councillor for just over a year now. So I was elected in... I was elected in May 2022, obviously, to Norwich City Council.
Dang! Baby councillor.
Yeah. No offense. Although I've now become the deputy leader of the Green Group and the official opposition. So, you know, diving in at the deep end yet again. But yeah, I mean, it's a huge variety of things. I think if you asked other councillors from other parties, the answers might vary. Casework is a big one. You know, you will be, councillors are in a very difficult position in this country whereby the government has had 13 years of brutal austerity that they do not want to take credit for. It's been an ideological choice that they have forced upon public services and local councils in this country to slash budgets that have obliterated communities across the country, whether that's rural or urban. And councillors are the ones that have to pick up the brunt of that. Because the people that will be helping these people are local councillors a lot of the time. And so there's a lot of casework and a lot of helping people. And to be honest, that is the most rewarding part of it, being able to, you know, help someone that is really, really struggling and actually see a positive outcome for them is really, really rewarding and a really great part of it. You know, it can be, there can be a lot of it to do. but honestly, it's a really good honour to do it. Door knocking is another one of them. I mean, I know that people just say that it's around election time, but actually, the success of the Green Party is that we do it year round, because the role of a councillor is to represent people. And the way that you do that is by going and speaking to them on different issues throughout the year. Scrutiny is a big one as well. I mean, the Greens are there scrutinising the work of the councils that they are on. And in some places, they are now running things as well. There's other committees, so you'll be making you can be making decisions about like a licensing application for a new pub that's opening, or you know, a taxi driver's license or a planning application. Or you can be on committees for like twinning committees is a fun one that I'm on, you know, that kind of decide where places are twinned with.
So twinning is like when you basically partner with a city in another country.
Yeah. And I mean,
so is Norwich twinned with somewhere?
Yeah, it's twinned. It's twinned with kind of four places.
Please tell me it's twinned with another city called Norwich.
No,
that'd be really
funny. No, it's not, I'm afraid, because there is a Norwich in the US, I believe.
Yes, there's a Norfolk in Virginia, in the US.
Yeah, that might be what I was thinking of. I mean, at this point, I mean, with brutal austerity, it's not like a twinning committee has much funding at all. It's probably like less than a grand a year. In Norwich, so it doesn't really do much, and the opportunities for what you can do is quite limited there. And that is honestly another shame of austerity, is that you have these brutal things that have ripped apart communities, but also it means that those cultural things that we have enjoyed for a long, long time are the first things to go, you know. And that, you know, losing those cultural aspects while also, you know, not being able to pay your bills is just like a double-edged sword. It's just hitting people doubly.
No bread or circuses in the end.
But then there's also just supporting people on a human level. A lot of the time you will feel like we are counsellors, but you'll feel like a counsellor, and that you just have to talk to people and just listen to them. And that can honestly be part of the job. Local action is probably the biggest one.
I remember someone described to me once that being a counsellor is more like being a social worker than it is like a legislator. Do you think that's like an accurate description?
Totally. I mean, the most effective counsellors and the ones that get re-elected are the people that do the work, support people and help people out of those situations, and are seen to be doing things in their community. Like we didn't gain the third seat in my ward because, you know, we'd passed, you know, motions about things at council meetings, or because we'd done this, you know, really detailed piece of work in a particular committee, which is really, really good. And some of the amazing work the Greens do, which is really important. But it's because we're supporting people and people can actually see us doing things in the community for them. And again, that is another impact of this Conservative government. Again, falls to the brunt of councillors, is that in so many cases, these services just don't exist anymore. Councils cannot afford them. They don't happen. Or where they do, you've got a lazy council that, you know, is bad at implementing them. And so Greens just pick up that work, whether it's like litter picking or like going around to all of your fly tipping hotspots and reporting it all.
I wanted to ask you on a more like personal level, what prompted you to join the Greens in the first place? Because obviously you've been a councillor for a year, presumably a member for a bit longer than that. I'm especially interested in what led you into the Greens rather than into the larger centre-left party of opposition, like Labour.
Yep. So I left the Labour Party. I was a member of the Labour Party, and I left back in 2014, so a while ago now. And the reason why I left, obviously Ed Miliband was leader of the Labour Party at that point, and they were in a similar position to where we find ourselves now. They are relatively undistinguishable from the Conservative Party in terms of what they're promoting. On an economic level, that's true, because they were really, really going hard on promoting austerity, at the same time as wanting to criticise the government for tearing apart communities. They were proposing the exact same cuts. And an element of that has stayed with the Labour Party since then. And it's come back in a pretty vicious way. But also, they've always been an incredibly authoritarian party, both in the kind of social policy that they support, but also in the way that they run their party. They don't have hugely democratic values, I would say, or that they are significantly weaker than the Green Party. I mean, they've never supported proportional representation. They are very happy to fall in line with an unelected House of Lords. They don't, you know, they don't really have any criticism of the monarchy either. And I've never really felt that they have been committed to the action on climate change that is necessary. It's always felt very tokenistic or had a coherence in their policy that recognized that social justice, economic justice, and climate justice are intrinsically linked. You cannot deal with any of those issues without dealing with them as a whole. And I've never seen that from the Labour Party. And in all of their years, I mean, it got significantly better with Jeremy Corbyn, definitely. But I was never convinced by it because there were still elements of that that they didn't recognise that key link between the two. And so that's why I was never really, that's why I left. And it was why I was never convinced to rejoin.
There's no need to spare Corbyn criticisms on my part. I like the guy. I was in the party supporting him. But, I mean, like I've said to people, great many failures. And you're exactly right when you say one of his greatest failures was he didn't change the party. I remember talking to Chris several years ago, and they were saying, I remember it so clearly because we were sitting on a bus together. And they were saying, I'm not going to join the Labour Party. I'm going to keep in the Green Party because Corbyn may be good, but he's one guy. The shadow cabinet's still mostly right wing. The parliamentary Labour Party is mostly right wing. The structures are incredibly anti-democratic. Reforming it is not a practical objective. From their perspective as well, it was more of a utility to the left to push them from the outside. And my opinion
Brexit
was like,
well,
yeah, well, this is pre-Brexit. This is 2015. I've been it's been way too long. And my opinion was that this is like a break in the sort of wall of the Labour right, and we need to flood through it, and we can get quite a bit done and people selected, and we can select people of the left more quickly and change the Labour Party. And ultimately, both of us pursued different paths, and one of us turned out to be very, very wrong, and the other was very, very right. The Labour Party remained right-wing in so many of its aspects and so many of its structures that the second that Corbyn was gone, it just went right back to what it was before. Absolutely, like, the speed at which it was done was absurd. Like, it was maybe 6 months and you would not have even known that Corbyn was leader. And he wasn't even a member of the parliamentary party after 6 months. And that was like, that just spoke to, like, as you say, how little it changed it.
I think also I looked at Labour and power as well. I looked at the areas where Labour are running things. And, I mean, if you look at some of their local councils, especially, like, their local councils in London, where you have seen huge campaigns of gentrification from led by Labour councils, demolishing council estates and pricing people out of their communities. I mean, and you see elements of that in Norwich as well. You know, we've had a massive development pass that just will not provide a level of affordable housing that's going to make any difference to anyone here. And so, again, I just wasn't convinced by it. And then Brexit hit, and I think that he undermined every single thing that he said with the actions that he took over Brexit. I mean, he fell in line behind Theresa May in a way that I really felt was shocking. And was willing to put everything on the line for that. Essentially, I'm a socialist, and that's why I left the Labour Party in 2014. And that's why I never returned, because I never saw a Labour Party that had become socialist again, in a way that I felt was genuine. You know, they had a leader who was saying great stuff, and it's great that he did that. And that was a massive thing in UK politics. It was groundbreaking when it happened. But it unfortunately showed that the Labour Party within itself just, I don't know, had given up fighting for those things. And like a thing that I was saying to people on the doorsteps in this election, you know, I wasn't asking people for general election votes or anything like that, because it was a local election, but people would would tell me every single day. Every single day I was door knocking about how disappointed they were and angry they were with the Labour Party and how, you know, that they had become so similar to the Conservatives. And all I could say to them is that I was so disappointed as well, that the Labour Party could be doing so much with the poll lead that it has. It could be arguing for so many positive things. And these things are so urgent, and the fact that they're not doing it is like, it makes me angry, but I'm just so disappointed. I really am. I'm so annoyed that my party has been the only one that's been, you know, standing with striking workers. Like, why is that the case? Like, yes, we've always been socialist, but Labour are supposed to be the ones supporting striking workers and standing up for like a public NHS and all these nationalisation of services, all these things. Yeah.
So the final sort of formal question I had was one of them the only sort of negative things about the local elections for the Greens, which is obviously lost Brighton, similarly got wiped out in York where they were also in administration, and a few other areas where they kind of did poorly. Didn't get devastated too badly, but Brighton was the big one. So it's more, I mean, you are active in Suffolk. I'm not going to, it would be fair to ask you, why do you think the Greens lost in Brighton? Because you may not even know the answer. If you do, of course, feel free to give opinions on it. But it's more like parties go up and down all the time. What do you think the party could learn from those setbacks and how it might be able to bounce back? Like, what lessons do you think could be drawn out from it?
Yeah, well, I think it's a good opportunity, actually, because, I mean, we are in administration in a lot of places and a lot more now as well than we were before this set of elections. And so it's a lesson that we definitely have to learn is defending our administrations and the messaging that is needed there and the different way of organising that you need and being able to counter a lot of misinformation in a positive way that doesn't go to that really negative style of campaigning that has been used against us. I mean, if you look at Brighton, that was nasty campaign by the Labour Party there. And we do have to remember that the only reason the Greens came into administration in Brighton and Hove was because the Labour Party abdicated responsibility there during a national pandemic. And the Greens had no choice but to take on the role. And in the years since then, the Labour Party has colluded with the Conservatives to put the Green minority administration in a position where it is unable to deal with a lot of issues properly, issues that were created by the Labour administration previous. And so they were the reasons why the Labour Party were able to then run such a negative campaign. But that's always going to happen. We're always going to see those tactics in any election, in any area. And we just need to be better at defending ourselves and really promoting the really good things that we have done in those areas. And it's a challenge that we just haven't had, you know, for it's very new to us as a party. And I mean, we've gone up and down in Brighton and other places, but it's a new challenge that obviously we haven't quite mastered. And so I actually think, like, it's really heartbreaking to see some really hardworking councillors who have done incredible things in Brighton and Hove. You, like, really led the way on, like, building social housing, which is difficult at the moment with the rules put on local authorities, really leading the way on reducing homelessness and things like that and getting the city through a pandemic with a minority administration is great. But we need to be so much better at promoting those achievements and countering that misinformation. And just need to see this as an opportunity to learn.
Yes,
because
indeed,
we actually have so many more administrations now. You know, we've got a majority administration. I mean, part of it was that we were a minority administration. And for any party, that is going to be so difficult to deal with because all the other parties might want to gang up on you. And that happened with the Labour and Conservatives in Brighton. You know, but we just have to see this as an opportunity to learn about how we properly defend administrations and promote the things that we have done in a really positive way and counter that misinformation and just, yeah, learn those lessons and adapt our way of organising.
It certainly is one interesting phenomenon that if the Greens had had the result they had in Brighton like 5 years ago, like losing, I think it was like from going about 20 seats to 7 and the opposition winning a two-thirds majority, it would have been a devastating defeat for the like the whole party. And in this year, it was just, oh, man.
There's a lot of people that didn't know it happened. There's a lot of Green Party members that probably still don't know that happened.
They lost Brighton.
Well, I was speaking to people and going out after the count in Norwich, and seeing like the 200 gains come in and that number increasing all the time. It was barely even national news that we had left, that we had lost administration in Brighton. So there were a lot of Greens that didn't really know about it. Dang. And so, yeah.
But no, I mean, it would have been headline news like 5 years ago, because it would have been the only administration and then lost. But this time it was like, there's so many others.
The difference is we're a national force in local elections now. So in the same way that you have with other parties, the national media won't necessarily report on those localised things. And they didn't.
I think there was, I remember I was going through the results. There's like one council where the Tories increased their majority substantially, and one where like Labour went backwards. And it's like, there's always these little local results that really only reflect specific local concerns, or just like Brighton being a very like left-leaning city and more responsive to the national mood, which is obviously more pro-Labour. I remember saying on Bright Green, like before in December, that I thought Brighton was like much more vulnerable than people thought. So mm-hmm. That was my like Nostradamus moment.
I mean, it's a real shame, and it's really sad, because the councillors there worked so hard in such a difficult situation, and they were at the hands of a really vicious campaign.
Oh yes, I'm not saying it was deserved at all. I was very sad to see it.
Yeah, but going forward, we just have to learn the lessons from that, really. I mean, my heart does go out to all those people, because it must be horrific. But yeah, we just need to learn the lessons from it.
I really appreciate you coming on to talk to me, Alex. It's been very, very interesting. And yeah, I'm sure I will see you again in person, because we live in the same city.
Yes, definitely. No, it's been a very, very interesting chat. So thank you for inviting me. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much again. I hope you have a good rest of your day. As always, I wanted to finish by saying a particularly strong thank you to the people who have signed up as comrades on Patreon. Alex Wilson, Barry James, Bert Rothkugel, Chloe Hopkins, Chris Gravel, Conrad, Michael Murray, Mick Mikatir, Neil Barton, Patrick Lefebvre, Paul Kazimowski, Ruth Holliday, Stephen Carr, Thomas Alexander, Editha De Silva, and Joseph Bailey. Really wonderful people. Thank you so much, guys. You make what I do possible, and I love you for it.